Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne. I'm going to let today's podcast guest introduce himself in character.
My name is Ron Swanson. You know, when I was 12, my brother shot me in the pinky toe with a nail gun. Granted, it was a hilarious prank, and we all had a good laugh. But I avoided going to the doctor. I hate paperwork. After a few weeks, the toe just kind of fell off.
You only have 9 toes?
I have the toes I have. Let's just leave it at that.
You know this guy as Ron Swanson, the meat-loving, whiskey-drinking, gun-toting Parks and Recreation bureaucrat. He's the character in NBC's award-winning Parks and Rec show, and he's played by the actor Nick Offerman, who gave his character over the years a number of his own personal traits, including some serious woodworking chops. Now, what you might not know is that in real life, Nick Offerman, the actor, is also a serious craftsman himself. He actually runs a woodworking shop and studio in Los Angeles, and he's a big fan of another master craftsman, Wendell Berry, the celebrated writer and farmer from Kentucky who has spent decades warning us about the dangers of modern technology and championing an off-the-grid, back-to-the-land lifestyle. Well, now there's a new documentary film out about Wendell Berry. It's called Look and See. Nick Offerman is the co-producer, and he was in town recently to promote the film, and he stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
Nick, I know you have been an admirer of Wendell Berry's work for years, and now you are co-producer of Laura Dunn's documentary about him. When did you first discover his writing?
I was doing a production of Sam Shepard's Buried Child at Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. And there was a great actor who sadly is no longer with us named Leo Burmester playing the role of Bradley in that play. And he immediately became an avuncular figure to me, kind of took me under his wing, a couple of rural dipshit types that ended up somehow in theater. And pretty soon into our friendship, he gave me a book of Wendell Berry short stories called Fidelity. And he said, I think you're going to like this writer. And I read those stories, and I mean, it was just deeply cathartic.
Cathartic? In what way?
Well, specifically, you know, I grew up in this great family in a small town called Minooka, Illinois, and the patriarch and matriarch of the family were my mom's parents, these farmers, and they farmed corn and soybeans and pigs. So I grew up with this idyllic, easily romanticized lifestyle that was sort of a 70s version of Little House on the Prairie, where a big family, many hands make light work. You know, we all do the dishes. We all had our chores. Everybody had a huge garden, you know. And my dad and mom both were very heroic in raising 4 kids on a pretty frugal school teacher's salary. And eventually, my mom went back to school and became a labor and delivery nurse. So, you know, just salt of the earth folks. Mm-hmm. And in Wendell Berry's writing, for the first time, I found an incredible writer, living writer, who wrote in such an elegiac fashion about the value and integrity of honest hard work. There's a scene in his novel, The Memory of Old Jack, where he describes Jack Beecham, the main character, and a laborer that he's hired. I think it's just post, you know, they've graduated from slavery, but still the hired hands that sort of live in a shack out back are still black people. And there's a massive, muscular, impressive worker named Will something, and the two of them are working on a fence together. And the way he describes, once they get into the rhythm of this simple, you know, honest work.
So it was the description, the writing about craft, about something that would seem as simple as making a fence, but doing it well. That appealed to you.
Absolutely. I mean, I've lived as a broke theater artist, and I've lived as a well-off Hollywood guy, sort of experiencing the spectrum of incomes. I've learned that sweeping a floor is every bit as satisfying, if not more so, than seeing your film play in a theater, because if your film makes it to a screen, a whole lot of people and a whole lot of budget had to come into that. But when you sweep that floor, that is your singular masterpiece.
Are you serious about this? This is not just a line you're feeding me?
Oh, no, I'm dead serious. I mean, it's the reason that I still maintain a wood shop in Los Angeles. I no longer need it and, frankly, have no time for it. It's foolish of me. But
you make beautiful furniture, right?
I do. I have six woodworkers there, and they're doing most of the making these days. But I still love to go there and work and sweep. I mean, it's the same thing as doing the dishes. I mean, you know, if you're lucky enough to sit down to a meal that's prepared in a home, let alone if some of the ingredients were grown at the home, that's an incredible gift that some people receive daily. And one way you can pay for it is to help with the dishes, or at least understand and appreciate the value of homegrown produce. Hmm.
So you became a fan of Wendell Berry. Did you go on and read a lot of his books then?
I did. I immediately started reading book after book, primarily his fiction for the first years. And pretty quickly, I wrote him a letter introducing myself.
Did he write back?
Well, he did. I asked him if I could adapt one of his stories. And he wrote back a very charming and friendly letter saying, no, I couldn't. And he said, you know, I'm not interested in seeing anybody's adaptation of my work. All of my fiction is of a piece. It's all sort of one huge pastiche that he just continues to add to. And so he didn't want to see anybody's interpretation sort of altering that in any way, which only made me respect him all the more. Hmm.
Well, it must have made you feel a little funny. I mean, here you are in the business of doing adaptations and, you know, working on screen. And here was a guy who didn't want to show up or have his work shown up on screen.
It is. But I got it immediately. I mean, and, you know, then I got onto his essays, which I appreciate his poetry. They're all, you know, he's a three-headed benevolent monster. But
and he's a farmer, too.
He is, yeah. Once I got onto his essays and nonfiction stuff about him, I learned, you know, that he has an aversion to screens of every sort, let alone the electronic screens that we think of. He's never had a television, and he doesn't even like a window if he can help it. He likes to be on the porch because then he's getting the full experience. He likes to smell and hear.
Well, and I remember reading years ago, he wrote an essay about how he writes everything by hand. And I think his wife, Tanya, then types it. He got some flack for that. Oh, you got your wife to, you know, type up your work.
He did.
But again, there's sort of this irony here. I mean, you know, you're famous for living out on screen, and here's a guy who wants nothing to do with screens.
And there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, it brings to mind the adage he lays out about how the amazing technology that we think is so wonderful for us and is in a lot of ways is also terrible for us. For example, he talks about how to get to town, you used to have to walk or at best go at the speed of a horse. And when you did that, you could still remain aware of the height of the water in the creek and how your neighbor's garden was doing, or how, you know, that other neighbor family, you could tell by the state of the barn's paint if he was still drinking or not. You know, once we were able to speed up with motor vehicles and such, yes, we got to town faster, but we lost the benefit of all that information. And by now, you know, very few of us know what kind of trees those are we're driving past. We can say, oh, those trees are pretty, but couldn't tell you if that was an elm or a maple or deciduous or conifer.
So you're really talking about kind of a homespun philosopher, and you sort of get his philosophy of what it means to live well through all of his writing, his poetry, his novels, his essays.
Yeah, I mean, it's replete with that stuff. And his economy as a writer is something I find very moving. And now that I've inexplicably become a writer myself, it was not something I expected to happen. You know, I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to reduce the number of words in my sentences to a Wendell Berry level. And that all comes from excluding all of those distractions from his life. He's able to have a singular focus, and that's part of what makes his writing so effective.
Even while I dreamed, I prayed that what I saw was only fear and no foretelling. For I saw the last known landscape destroyed for the sake of the objective, the soil bulldozed, the rock blasted. Those who had wanted to go home would never get there now. I visited the offices where, for the sake of the objective, the planners planned, at blank desks set in rows. I visited the loud factories where the machines were made that would drive ever forward toward the objective. I saw the forest reduced to stumps and gullies. I saw the poisoned river, the mountain cast into the valley.
So there's a new documentary out about Wendell Berry. You are a co-producer.
I am.
How did you get involved in this film?
Well, I continued corresponding with him over the years. I tried, you know, when he refused to let me adapt anything, then I tried to just get to come meet him. I would read interviews where people would say, well, it took me 10 years, but Wendell said, listen, I don't have time to do an interview, but if you want to come work with me on the farm, you can ask me questions while we're working.
His farm in Kentucky.
So I immediately wrote him and said, listen, I'm well trained in the shovel, the hoe, the axe, and I can haul many bales of hay. And he wrote back and said, you know, I'm not doing a lot of manual farming anymore, but I enjoy our letters. So I kept, you know, trying to get at him just because he's my Shakespeare. One of the wonderful headquarters of my film life is the city of Austin, Texas. I've been going to the South by Southwest Film Festival for many years, and I have a lot of friends in town. And a mutual friend of me and Laura Dunn, the filmmaker, said, hey, my friend Laura is making a documentary about Wendell. And I said, good Lord, please introduce me. So she did, and she had already completed most of the principal photography. And I said, listen, I'm so excited, first of all, that you're making this movie, and B, if there's anything at all I can do, I'll drive a truckload of cable, whatever it takes. And she said, well, with your visibility, you'd actually be very valuable to us if you kind of came on as a cheerleader. And I said, great. So I immediately started raising funds for post-production. And they generously then made me a co-producer once I showed up and started sweeping.
And you make an appearance in the film.
Well, that came later, yeah.
Okay.
As she was cutting the film, there's this beautiful thing Wendell says where he yearns for an age of marriage in the sensibility of the way small farming communities used to operate. And now she points out that we've kind of come to an age of divorce where our society wants to take things apart a lot more than put them together. And he says, well, that's, you know, that's what artists do. They see two things that they think ought to go together and they put them together. He said, the way you'll make this film is by looking at the pieces you've shot and figuring out how they go together. And I took note that his first thought of fine art was a stool. Hmm. And Laura said, would you mind making a stool and we'll shoot it and put it under him saying this in the movie? And we did. And it's just shots of my hands and tools.
All right. We never see your face.
No. And so for all those reasons, I think it will turn out to be the peak of my career.
Your moment with Wendell Berry.
I'll tell you, sincerely, I have a hard time watching it without welling up because I just admire him so profoundly, and to in any way have my work associated with his, I can't imagine a greater honor.
We all come from divorce. Now, this is an age of divorce. Things that belong together have been taken apart. And you can't put it all back together again. What you do is the only thing that you can do. You take two things that ought to be together and you put them back together. Two things, not all things. That's what we do. We people who make things.
if it's a stool or a film or a poem or an essay or a novel or a musical composition, it's all about that, fitting it together.
So I'm assuming you finally met him.
We did. During the course of the filming, Laura made sort of an introduction and told his family, you know, as you can imagine, especially in the world of agrarianism and with the growing popularity of farm-to-table sensibility, there has been a great clamoring to get to Wendell for decades now, really since The Unsettling of America came out in the 70s.
His classic book about his critique of industrial agriculture.
Yeah. And so it took that hookup where Laura let them know that I was okay. And so they agreed. It was so funny. Through his daughter, Mary, who's become a good friend, and she's the greatest general. If everything ever comes to a crumbling halt, I'm going to find her and line up in her army because she gets things done.
She's also great in this film, too. See her say, opine about what her father's like and, you know, what life is all about.
Having her become an incredibly effective leader in the family and the movement, hearing her recollections of being the child of Wendell and Tanya is really moving.
Things that my parents thought were important for us to notice, they told us to notice. Look at this, see that it's good, and don't forget. Whatever field we were in, whatever walk we took, we were told to look and see. What is that tree? What is this grass? That field was plowed incorrectly. Why is that? What should have been done? That man is a great farmer. See what he does. That is beautiful. Look and see that it's beautiful.
So with Mary, I was afforded a Sunday afternoon in October, and I'll tell you, I don't get nervous, I don't get too starstruck anymore, but driving just past the signs that said Henry County, suddenly I had goosebumps, and I came down along the river, and even though Port William is a fictional town in all of his writing, it's based on this home place in this area. So I got to meet him, and they generously gave me an afternoon around the kitchen table.
What was he like? I mean, after you'd sort of been thinking and obsessing about him for all these years.
He was just like I had hoped. You know, sometimes you meet your heroes and they're very disappointing. But Wendell, as Tanya said, she's a wonderful character as well. She is every bit as heroic and gorgeous as he is. He's the first to say he's nothing without her. It takes both of them in their marriage. And so you can tell he likes to tell stories. And, you know, you put a quarter in that guy, you just say, you know, organized religion, go. And you have to cut him off at some point, which is painful, but she wonderfully will sit there and shake her head.
She's the one who kind of brings him down to earth a little bit.
Well, she does, or you know, it's one of those, it's a marriage, so sometimes he'll say, Tanya, what was that fellow's name in Kansas City? And so I just was happy as a pig in mud, is a friendly version of that figure of speech. You know, we had tea. I brought him a nice bottle of bourbon, which was a tip I had received, and that was well received. And she made a lunch of their own lamb and their garden vegetables. So I mean, it was my version of Disneyland. And and then towards the end of it, I said, "Listen, I don't want to overstay my welcome. Let me know, you know, when you've tired of me." And he said, "Well, do you want to see my barn?" I said, "Yes, I would very much like to." And he said, "Well, I'll show you the barn and then you can leave."
You get another, you know, 45 minutes.
And even that is, I'm so grateful to him. You know, he had given generously to me of his time. And even his curt parting gesture was gracious and poetic. And we went and looked at his barn, and you know, it was down the lane through the woods that he had written about. And, you know, it's really interesting to consider myself perhaps a clumsy ambassador of, you know, he has the talent and the wisdom and the lifestyle to create what he creates. I don't. I live in Los Angeles, but I do have the sensibility to value his work the way I do, and then I have the audience.
But it seems that there's another connection here. I mean, you both celebrate craftsmanship, making stuff by hand. I mean, you're a woodworker. You also, I assume that, you know, you think a lot about the craft of being an actor. And he celebrates craft and, you know, his writing, his farming. It's kind of, I don't know, old world values, maybe.
I suppose. I mean, and that's the conundrum, is convincing the new world that it should also be the new world values. And that's why I feel such a profound connection to him. All these lessons I got from my family. I mean, once I got my head out of my ass in my early 20s and said, oh, geez, I gotta grow up here and get something done, I was so grateful. I called my dad, who I was a pain in the rear to, like you're supposed to, in my later teens. And early on in college, I remember calling him and saying, hey, I get it. The three things you just simply kept repeating to me, be honest, you know, work hard. You tell the truth and nobody can ever call you on it. And it took me a long time to
Well, and we might mention that your dad is actually sitting right on the other side of the glass here. So I'm guessing that he appreciates what you're saying here.
I hope so. I mean, he knows I talk about him and my mom a great deal, because they absolutely made me. And I figured out at some point, you know, I can't always come up with clever things to say, so I'll just tell you what my mom and dad told me, or Wendell, or a couple other great teachers I've had. One of my other great teachers is a Japanese artist named Shozo Sato, who taught at the University of Illinois, where I went to theater school. And he taught a curriculum of Zen arts. And I was always really taken with the notion that really every part of your life, you can choose to curate it in an artistic way. You know, you don't have to settle for just what's on the shelf at the grocery store or what's in the catalog or what have you. If you don't like the tables that are available to you, you can make your own damn table. And that goes for everything. And since the Industrial Revolution, consumerism has been so successful that so much of our population has forgotten that we can make our own implements. We can.
Right. Well, so I want to ask you a little bit more about that. So you've already said, you know, you have this wood shop in L.A. Of course, your character, Ron Swanson, was the great woodworker in Parks and Recreation. Do you have a favorite thing you like to make?
You know, in the shop, it's really whatever's on the bench, whether it's a canoe or a cooking spoon. It's the magic of being able to turn a useless plank into an implement of use.
Do you have sort of a platonic version of that? Like, is there a perfect chair or a perfect canoe?
Well, now you're dipping into some William Ruskin, where its value and its charisma has everything to do with its usability rather than how much gingerbread you can carve on.
You don't want to just look at it.
No, I quickly learned, partly because I don't have a lot of finesse in me, that I was never going to be I wasn't going to work a lot in the federal period, because there was this furniture style, you know, the craftsman movement, where they said, you know what, let's get rid of all this decoration and make the actual joinery the decoration, and it's related to timber framing, and I said, hey, that's the style for me, because then there's a humility involved, where instead of showing you how clever or fancy my own work is, I get out of the way of Mother Nature. And so maybe the platonic version is the bread and butter of my shop are these slab dining tables. And in California, in a lot of the country, you can still get old growth trees that are big enough, deciduous trees, oak and maple and walnut, where you can get a 4-foot by 8-foot slice of a tree. And without fail, any piece of wood of that ilk has so much charisma and art and just astonishing depth in it that we just get out of her way and, you know, put a nice finish on it.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about the charisma of wood. Because, I mean, charisma is, you know, a word I would associate with your other profession, acting. Are there connections between the two?
I suppose. I mean, I have to squint my eyes pretty hard to say in both pursuits, you know, you want to keep your tools honed so that you can sculpt a pleasing creation for your audience or your, you know, the client of the furniture with as much alacrity as possible. I don't know. It all comes from the same impetus to use what creativity I've been given to make things that are pleasing to people. Sometimes that's to make them laugh, but, you know, because I fall down well. Or sometimes it's to make them a place where they can cut their pork chops and rest their beer. And a lot of stuff in between. So I guess, you know, in an elemental way, it comes from the same place.
Now, to come back to this documentary about Wendell Berry, Look and See, there's something kind of fascinating about how this is made. I mean, this is a movie about him. He never actually appears in the movie. I mean, there's some archival footage of him from decades ago, and that must have been a neat trick.
Well, that was certainly a challenge. Now,
I assume this is because he wouldn't consent to being filmed on camera.
That's correct. He was not interested. And in brief, Laura Dunn fell in love with Wendell's work and decided she really wanted to make a movie about him and his message. So it took a few years of campaigning to even get them to come around to give her permission. And that was one caveat, was he said, "All right, I'll agree to this movie, but you can't shoot me."
Even though it's a movie about me, you can't shoot me.
Which is so beautiful. I mean,
so we do hear him talk and we hear him read, but we never see him.
Yes. And she said, "You know what? I'm going to take that challenge and I'm going to make the best damn lemonade you've ever seen." And she did. I mean, at the beginning of the film, there's a piece where he's talking about the limitations of a camera. And he says, "You know, films are neat and all, but the thing I don't like about it is whatever you're seeing in your frame, you're not getting the whole experience. You can't hear what's going on in the woods." And so she puts this against a walk through the woods on a ridge on his farm. I think that she kind of works ironically against what he's saying.
"If my work is writing, then I have to make sure that I do it. That's why I don't participate in films. The limits of a camera is that it's always looking through a frame. There's certain things that you can't show that living eyes can see. To determine where to set that lens, where it's going to look from, requires imagination."
Sitting in a theater, you think, this is pretty damn terrific, Wendell, if you could wrap your head around it.
Yeah. Wait, has he seen the movie? Do you know?
I don't think he has. I just saw Mary, his daughter, and his wife, Tanya, came to Sundance, which was quite wonderful. You know, especially Tanya doesn't travel that much anymore. And so it was a great honor to see it at Sundance. Robert Redford introduced it, and I've got a good story about him in a second. And it's really neat because we all, you know, have such hero worship of Wendell, to talk to his daughter and his wife, where they immediately start laying on what they hate about the movie, or, you know. And they've come around to really like the final product, but it's been through a few iterations. It used to be, for example, called The Seer. And they just hated that because it put too much emphasis on Wendell.
Turned him into a prophet.
It did, yeah. It gave him a prescience that he didn't want to be associated with. And so they changed the title. And Tanya had notes that were incorporated into re-edits of the movie. But last I heard, they recently sent them a Blu-ray player and a copy of the movie.
Oh, you got to send the machine to be able to play the movie.
Yeah, and they're going to have to go to somebody's house to hook it up to a television. So I don't believe he's seen it yet. But that's part of the beauty. You know, he's in his way, he's the hermetic wise man in a cave, and you kind of don't ever want him to come to town because it's from his isolation, and it's not a great term because he's not isolated. It's his solitude among his farming community and his family. I mean, he has as much fun and he's as busy as anybody. It just doesn't involve sitting in front of a TV or a computer.
Yeah. Now, you said there's a story about Robert Redford introducing the film.
There is. When The Unsettling of America came out in, I want to say, 76 or 78, as we said, it sort of took the world of especially the conservation-minded by storm. And immediately people said, who's this great thinker in Kentucky? And one day the phone rang in the Berry household, and Tanya answered and said, Wendell, it's for you. And she was a little nervous, and he said, hello? Well, thank you. Okay. No, I'm not interested. Okay, no, thanks. No, I wouldn't care to. Have a nice day. Goodbye. And he hung up the phone and turned to her and said, who the hell is Robert Redstone? And she had been to the movies, you know, she was awfully nervous to hear this. And and so that, you know, that became a great anecdote in the household. And so 40-some years later, 50 years later, Robert Redford introduced the movie at his film festival. He also, I should mention, he and Terrence Malick also supported this film as well. They're great patrons of Laura's. And so he introduced the film, and we did a bit of a photo shoot. And I made sure that I was in all the photos with Tanya and Robert.
I'm glad to hear that.
So that I could tell Wendell I had his back.
One last thing. Speaking of craft and craftsmanship, I understand that you and Amy Poehler have a new TV show coming out about, a reality TV show about craftsmanship?
It is. It's a, it's a very fun sort of competition show, bringing people, all, crafts of every stripe together to sort of make things in a competitive way. It's coming off the inspiration of the baking shows that have been very popular. And Amy has a production company, and it was her idea. And she pitched it to me, and I've danced around a couple different crafting reality shows recently, and I almost tricked myself into doing it, thinking it would buy me some shop time. And at the last second, I realized, oh, I'm not going to get shop time out of this. I'm going to be too busy producing television when what I want to be producing is cowboy boots or stained glass windows. So she pitched this to me, and it's kind of all fun, and I have the advantage of they have all the headache. They're producing the show, and we just get to celebrate people who make things. And so I jumped on board, and, you know, we have so much fun screwing around together that I don't see the downside if there is one.
And when are we going to see this?
We're going to shoot it in the fall, so it'll probably come out in we're looking at the schedule right now, but we should see it before Halloween, I should think.
I look forward to seeing that. Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
My pleasure. There's no state I admire more than Wisconsin, and there's no radio program I'd rather be on than this one. So this is a treat for me.
Thank you. It's a treat for me, too.
Actor and woodworker Nick Offerman talking with Steve Paulson. Offerman is a co-producer of the new documentary film about Wendell Berry. It's called Look and See. I'm Ann Strainchamps. For more episodes of To the Best of Our Knowledge, check our podcast feed. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, based in Madison, Wisconsin, and distributed by Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.